Welcome to Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, the podcast that delves into the diverse and impactful roles scientists can play beyond the lab, with me, David Mendez. Today, I have the great pleasure of having with me Dominique Louer. Dominique is a fourth-year PhD candidate in Communication Sciences and Disorders at McGill University, specializing in neurolinguistics. Her research explores the intersection of bilingualism, brain function, and aging. She completed her undergraduate studies in linguistics at the University of Winnipeg and went on to earn two master's degrees at the University of Waterloo in linguistics and psychology, respectively. Drawing from her multidisciplinary background in linguistics and in psychology, Dominique advocates for holistic aging solutions, emphasizing the importance of factors like bilingualism in maintaining cognitive health. In her spare time, she enjoys spending time outside, drinking overpriced lattes with friends, and bouldering. Welcome to Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, Dominique.
Thank you so much for having me.
So bouldering, can you, this is a term that I didn't know. I think I can imagine what it is, but can you tell the audience what it's all about?
Yeah, so bouldering is rock climbing, but without a harness or without anything attached to you. So it's really just climbing without any of the attachments.
I think I've seen some people bouldering in the Laurentians, and then you have these kind of foldable mattresses that you fall onto. Is that the type of thing?
Yeah. And I actually do most of my bouldering at an indoor gym. So they have all of the mats and equipment and everything for us to fall.
Excellent. I had to ask because I was curious, since I read your bio. So clearly you're an active person. Today here that we're talking about thriving as a first gen graduate student. So that's where we're going to go with the conversation. But, you know, every journey starts with a first step, with a starting point. And in conversation with you, you shared with me something that was a bit troubling to me because I have children in school, one of them in high school now. And something happened to you in school to do with your potential future in academia that really was, it was troubling to me just to think that it might happen to one of my children. Can you tell us a little bit about this event, this interaction that you had, and about, because it connects with this question of being first gen, with other things too that you shared with me. But yeah, what happened in high school that could have changed your orientation, your journey from being now in a PhD to maybe not having gone into higher studies at all?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I struggled a lot, specifically with math. So math was definitely not my strong suit. I think a lot of people can relate to this, but I just had a lot of problems in math class. And during one of the parent-teacher conferences that the school held, one of the teachers had a conversation with my mom where he told her, and I was also there, but he told her, you know, your daughter is struggling a lot in math, and I really don't think that she has the potential to continue her studies after high school. I don't think she's going to go to university.
Oh, wow.
And that conversation, you know, it really affected me. It really made me feel like a failure, like I wasn't good enough. I was, you know, and I was already having a lot of difficulty with this class in particular. And to hear him say that, to sort of like shut me down and, you know, it just made me feel really badly about myself because I did want to go to university. So this was around the time where we started thinking about university. So this is like the later years of high school where, you know, you're kind of thinking, okay, what am I going to do next? And I had always planned on going to university. It was something that I was interested in. You know, I had plans to be a teacher and to go to school and that's what I wanted to do. And to have someone say that was really hard to hear. You know, it really affected me. And I remember going home that day and just feeling so sad. Like, I just didn't know what to do. And not only did it affect me, but it also affected my parents, specifically my mom. You know, she really thought, you know, my daughter is just not going to have a future in school. And she really wanted me to go to school. You know, for her, education is such an important thing. And she really believed this teacher who said that. She said, well, he's, you know, he's with my daughter a lot. He must know that she's just not competent enough. And anyways, that's sort of, it really affected me, and it still affects me to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's big. I believe it was a big misstep on the person's on his part. And you're in, you know, at that age, you're kind of trying to figure out who you are personally, and more, and you know, in projecting yourself into a sort of future in terms of learning and work, etc. And to have someone tell you that it could have totally destroyed you and made you, if you had, you know, believed and taken it to face value, you might have simply said, okay, then I need to do something else with my life. Thankfully, that's not what happened.
Thankfully, yes.
So what happened after that? So how did you kind of digest that and, you know, and move forward with your plans? Because one thing that I take from this story is your sadness at hearing this, I think, was the sign that you were actually, you know, destined to be, or at least your the path that was close to your heart was of learning more. So that's why you were that sad at the moment. So that could have been a sign for your parents of, yeah, you know, let's trust her a little bit and let her move on. Was that what happened?
It was, yeah. Well, two things happened. The first is that I did decide to go to university, but I actually changed what I wanted to do. So I was always really interested in science and psychology and biology. And the university that I applied to, they did have they had a psychobiology program, which to me would have been the most perfect thing to study. That's actually what I do now. But back then, because I was told, you know, you're not strong enough in math, I actually ended up taking a math course in high school that made it so that I couldn't study science in university. So the way it worked, so I went to school in the province of Manitoba, and the way it works there is that in order to go to university and to take science, you have to take calculus or pre-calculus in high school. But because I had this conversation with the teacher, he told both me and my parents, you know, she's not good enough to take pre-calculus. So they enrolled me in this, like, I forget what it was called, some type of like life math where you learn how to do your taxes, and you know, it's super helpful, but it's not good if you want to go in STEM or study sciences. So I took that. Because I took that, the only option I had was to do an arts degree, a humanities degree, which was fine and I loved it, but I decided to just study languages. So my first degree was very humanities focused. You know, I was studying linguistics and literature and sociology, but I didn't take any math or science classes. So in a way, that sort of, it made it harder when I decided to pursue my studies, because now I'm very much in, you know, I'm in neuroscience, so a lot of math and science. But back then, I thought my only option was to just study languages. And I don't regret that, because I think it led me to where I am today. But it definitely, it hindered me a little bit in terms of what I ended up doing later. So
yeah, it was more of a roundabout path.
Exactly.
You know, based on that choice that you had to make. And so you mentioned difficulty with math. Is that something you know, is that something that with time, because now you, like we said, you kind of, came full circle and are now working in the interface of neuroscience and linguistics. How did you end up dealing with that supposedly, that supposed gap that would preclude you from accessing this type of domain? What how did you navigate that?
Yeah, so when I had to start taking math classes during my master's degree, I was really stressed out about it. So, you know, just with all this childhood experience of having really a bad time with math and knowing that I was bad at math, I definitely felt a lot more stressed about it than I should have been. But it was really just, I guess, just having to like go through it and to, you know, to force myself to persevere and just telling myself, you know, you can learn this, you will learn this. And just going through that initial step of like forcing myself to do it really helped. And it was so funny because I realized as I was taking these math classes during my master's that I was actually doing okay. I wasn't bad. You know, I was getting good grades, and I was, you know, there's still a bit of a lack of understanding. And I think that's because I didn't take any math during my undergrad. But just realizing that, wait, I can do this, really, really helped me. And also asking for help too. You know, I went into this feeling really, really scared, but knowing that there was people around me that I could ask questions to, you know, professors that are really receptive to different types of learning styles, that really helped too. And just having those conversations with people saying, you know, I've always struggled with this, but I'm here to learn and I want to learn. I think just having that mindset of like, I need to do this to progress really helped. And then also realizing that it is something that you can do despite having difficulty. Like, I think anyone can learn a subject that they struggle with if that's what they want to do and if they have the right tools and the right support to them.
And the right mentors, like that person in high school was not the right person. They could have nurtured, you know, your desire to go to science and try to get you to learn. Maybe also, you know, we go through life through our different ages maturing, our brain matures, and the way we are able to deal with stuff that looked super complicated when we were quite young, we can now learn them because also we've done many more things, and we can now deal with data in a different way. But it feels like, yeah, there was some redemption there to something that was, I just had an episode about contamination stories and redemption stories, and you really, I think you came full circle with redemption of, yes, now I'm in neuroscience, yes, now I can use math in my research, and I'm happy doing it, and it's marvelous. Now, the episode is titled Thriving as a First Gen Graduate Student, and in our pre-interview we talked about different things that throughout life have been obstacles. That first one that we mentioned, someone telling you you're not, you're not built for research or for academia or whatever. I don't, you know, they probably said it a different way, but that was the message. But then there are other aspects that you had discussed with me that led to you. And now, of course, this question with math is for sure one of them, led to you having to deal with imposter feelings at different points during this journey. And I'm sure, because you're in graduate school, you're doing a PhD, I'm sure that imposter feelings come up sometimes for you and for your colleagues, by the way. It's not just you. do you want to talk a little bit more about what other challenges you had to deal with, like internally, and you know, throughout your academic and now moving to almost this professional phase of your life, that have to do with personal traits of yours, but also this problematic, I'd say, of not having within your family role models for keeping studying, going to university, going to graduate school, etc., etc. Can you talk a little bit about that part of things and how you dealt with that along the way?
Yeah. So, like you said, I think this is a really common remark from a lot of grad students, is that, you know, we're dealing with this major, major imposter syndrome. But a lot of us are also dealing with a lack of support from people who are close to us, people who've also gone through this journey of grad school. And it wasn't until I got to McGill that I realized that a lot of people do have academic parents or siblings or people in their circle, their close circle, who have PhDs. And it's actually very common. And I didn't realize this until I started studying here. But I think it's definitely, it's hard to deal with being a first generation student, a first generation grad student, because you don't know what you're doing. And there's no one there to guide you and to tell you what to do. You know, there's a lot of people who, you know, they're very lucky and their parents are also professors. So they were kind of like built for this, you know, ever since they were little, they always knew what a PhD was and they knew the type of work that it took to do one. And I think that that's a huge advantage. And I also just want to point out, I'm not saying that just because someone has an academic parent, it means that things are easy for them. That's not at all what I think. I think everyone struggles, and I just want to make sure people know that. I'm very aware that this is difficult for everyone, but I think that there are certain advantages and disadvantages to having, you know, support from your parents in that sense, versus not having anyone in your family. And what was I saying?
Well, let me say something. So I agree, like, a PhD is difficult for everyone who's doing it. But it's true that if you have a sibling, a parent who's gone through it, one of the first things that become easier is just the whole logistics of getting into a program, of knowing, you know, of kind of knowing the ropes of what is expected of you. Also, strategies to, you know, to plan your work, to publish, to write, etc. You know, it's a lot of unknowns to be dealing with when you're a first gen, that if you have someone close to you who's gone through it, they can at least, like I said, show you the ropes. And that's already a big load off your shoulders in terms of having to discover and make sense and make the best out of the short time that you have to go through this ordeal.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's so many moments where I realized that, you know, not having that is difficult, you know. And one thing in particular that comes to mind is the process of grant writing. So, you know, as students, we often have to apply for grants or scholarships, you know, to get more funding or funding in general for our degrees. And a lot of it is just very, you wouldn't know what to include unless someone told you, hey, this is important, you should include this. Like, I didn't realize until very late that I was supposed to be like talking about myself as though I was some amazing person who's done so many things. You know, like, it's just, when I first wrote a grant application, I was just writing the bare minimum. You know, I don't want to make myself sound better than I am. I just want to say what's there. But I didn't realize the amount of embellishing that goes into all of these applications. Whereas someone who, you know, has a parent who also writes grants for a living, they could easily say, hey, you know, this is how you want to structure it. And this is how you want to frame yourself. And, you know, you want to come across as like very, very good and competent. And also the type of non-academic work that you need to do to get a grant. So there's so many things that you need to include in these applications. You need to be volunteering, you need to be teaching, you need to be working as a research assistant, but also be, you know, doing your own work. You need to be publishing, you need to be on all of these different committees, and you basically have to be doing everything that's possible. And a lot of us don't know that. You know, we do volunteer and we do serve on committees, but it's just, you know, it's not because we want to get grants. It's just things that we enjoy doing. But I didn't realize the amount of things you had to be implicated in just to even be considered for this type of funding. And I'm talking about like the more like, you know, provincial, national scholarships, like the ones that are really competitive. Like no one tells you that. You know, like I wish I had known, okay, you know, as soon as I start my undergrad, I need to start volunteering in a lab. I didn't know. I didn't work as a research assistant until much, much later. Whereas some people, they already know from the beginning, okay, I need to be doing this. I need to be doing that. I need to publish a paper, which is extremely time consuming and difficult. But there's all of these things that you just don't know until you're told or until you get that first rejection. And you're like, oh, okay, this something didn't work. And I don't know what it was, but you know, it's kind of like a trial and error process rather than just already knowing and being told this is what you need to do. So I think that is like a good example of the disparity between, you know, a first generation student and someone who does have that support from a family member.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's the unknown unknowns. Those are the ones that are hard. And I went through the same, you know, I went through it the same way as you, and I probably even did less than what you have been doing. And yeah, it's, of course, it's not a given that just because you have a parent who went to graduate school that they're going to, you know, be reviewing what you write, but at least, you know, they're a good sounding board for at least you not going through things, you know, just happenstance and without strategy. And clearly there's a strategy to the whole system that if you're not privy to it, well, you're just going to not be able to perform as well. Yeah. And how was it then that you learned about these things and got to kind of fixing these gaps that you found? Did you find community with other colleagues? How did that happen for you?
Yeah, definitely through friends and colleagues that were also going through it. So I think one of the really important things is to find that community, you know, find people who are having similar struggles as you and just being open about your problems and hearing what they have to say. And there are so many of us that are dealing with the same problems. And I'm very lucky that in my department, you know, I have really, really great friends and colleagues who are very supportive and very just nice people to talk to. And I think just talking to them, you know, getting their advice, asking for help, that's been so important and so helpful in my journey.
And do you have mentors outside academia, outside the lab, that also help you? Were you able? Not everyone finds them, but I always ask the question because I think it's there's potential to help people who are watching and listening.
Yeah, definitely. So I've been very lucky to work with a number of people who are not physically in Montreal, but that I can still stay in touch with, who've been really helpful throughout the process. So both in and outside of academia. And yeah, past, I'm thinking of past colleagues or past employers who I've stayed in touch with and who've been really, really great in, you know, supporting me and helping me through not only the academic side, but also the emotional side and the stress and all the other stuff that comes with it.
And I don't know if you have an example of something, a little small story around that type of mentorship that you can tell, but maybe if you don't have a story to tell, maybe can you share a little bit about how that relationship works? What, you know, at what moment do you go and reach out to one of these external mentors, and you know, what's the dynamic of the relationship? Why does it work and why does it help you?
The person that came to mind when I was talking about this is a woman that I met through the Wisdom Exchange Project. So this is a project that started at McGill, and it puts graduate students in touch with an older adult who either lives in Toronto or in Montreal. And I'm very lucky to have been partnered with someone that I've become really good friends with. And she's in Toronto, but we actually talk once a week. And she has been such a wonderful person to talk to. So she's not an academic, but she's someone that I look up to a lot, both professionally and just in terms of the way that she is with other people. And, you know, because we have this set time that we're able to talk, so I always talk with her on Tuesday afternoons. I know that, you know, I get to chat with her about what's going on with me and with her and just kind of have that conversation. So I don't necessarily reach out to her when things happen, but I know that I have that set time where I will be able to tell her how things are going and to hear from her too.
And so you get energized from just from that interaction, from that relationship. Can you tell the name of the program again? Because it sounds like a really cool thing. So if McGill students listening hear about, listen what Dominique has to share, because it sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's called the Wisdom Exchange Project. And there's McGill, I think it started at McGill, but there's a couple universities in Ontario as well who take part in it. And it was an initiative that started during the pandemic. So when people were experiencing a lot of loneliness and isolation. And as I mentioned before, the idea is to pair a graduate student with an older adult. And it's really up to the two people to decide what type of relationship they want to have. So in my case, we FaceTime each other once a week for about an hour. But I know other people, you know, they'll just do like once a month, they'll call each other or even just text each other. So it's really open to all different types of communication. But I really encourage people to look into that if it's something they're interested in, because it's a really great way to make a connection with someone who has a lot of life experience and who can sort of mentor you and help you out with things.
Now, a question. So going back to your academic journey, you're now in the fourth year of your PhD. I just saw you do a great job last week at your 3-minute thesis competition here in Montreal. Congratulations again on that, on winning that. You said you did 2 master's degrees. This is a little bit of a joke, but is this all out of spite for that teacher in high school? Are you going for a second PhD after this? Well, you don't have to answer that. Actually, my real question. So this was the funny, jokey question. The real question is, you were super sad when you were told you weren't cut for academia. You went a different way a little bit because of math, like you said, and then you go on to do a first master's, and then you do a second master's, and now you're in a PhD. You're doing well. You're communicating your science in a very professional and effective way. Can you share a little bit with us of what it is that has been keeping you going in this journey into and through the academic path, let's say? There's something in there that you know, some kind of guiding star for you, I feel.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different things that I want to say about this. First of all, I definitely am kind of thinking a lot about this past experience. And, you know, I'm not doing my PhD out of spite, but there is a part of me that is fueled by this desire to just prove people wrong. And I know that's not the best motivator, but it's working for me. And I think just having been told so many times, you know, it wasn't just this teacher, there were other teachers, there was, you know, people in my close circle who were kind of like, you know, you're not very good at school. And, you know, they didn't really see much happening for me in the future. And I think those experiences and those interactions that I had when I was younger definitely, it did something to me that made me really want to prove them wrong. So part of it is that, I won't lie, part of it is that, but I also do have this very big interest in what I do. So I love learning. I've always loved learning. For me, you know, being in school, being a student and having all these opportunities to learn about so many different subjects is so fun, and I do love that. I'm also really interested in the research that I do. So I've always had this interest in, you know, language and the brain, and also working with older adults. That's something that I enjoyed a lot when I was younger. And so combining all of these interests is something that, you know, it helps. I think it really helps when you're passionate and you're interested about what you're doing, but also thinking a lot about those past experiences and just saying, you know what, I need to do this. And there have been moments where I really wanted to stop my studies. You know, I actually went through a big period of burnout a couple years ago, about halfway through my degree, where I was just so tired and so mentally exhausted that I actually took a leave of absence from my program because I couldn't do it anymore. But throughout that time, I was really reflecting on this goal that I had put for myself. And I thought, you know what, if I stop now, I'm never going to be satisfied. I think that if I quit, there's a part of me that would just regret it so much and not be able to feel at peace. So I really want to finish my PhD just to, like, you know, say, you know, I did it and it's done. And yeah, it's like this big journey, you know, it's been 10 years. Like I really, really want to finish it. And I just keep telling myself, you know, you're going to be so happy and so proud once it's done. And that's what I repeat to myself all the time when I'm thinking about quitting. Cause I did, like I said, I did go through that period where I was like, I think I'm done and I think I'm going to stop. And, you know, I talked to my supervisor and I talked to a lot of my colleagues and I said, I think this is it for me. But then I came back and now I'm really set on wrapping things up and finishing within the next year or so. So
a lot of us go through that experience of considering quitting. I am repeating this. This is not the first time I say this, but I think it needs repeating. If your mental health is paying too high a price for you to stick with this plan and to please someone that you think expects you to accomplish this thing that's a PhD, you better take a break and even maybe stop, because nothing is worth your mental health. Now, can I ask you, because I think this is very, very important. It's tough to stop because of what I just said. There's a lot of expectations outside. You know, there's this host of people that you want to, you know, that you want to say, here, I have my degree too, that we've already mentioned. But even to pause is tough because you can get this feeling of, it's almost a FOMO type thing, but it's, I can, you know, if I stop at this station, I don't know if I can catch the train again. Can you go a little deeper into how that reflection was with you? When did the reflection or the notion come of, okay, no, I need to take a real break and consider if I'm going to finish this or not? And yeah, I'm going to stop here and I have a follow-up question. But what made you get to that? How was the path to that conclusion of, okay, I need to take a break?
So a lot of things happened when I started my PhD. I started in 2020, so the year of the pandemic. So that was huge. You know, I moved to Montreal. I didn't know anyone in the city. Everything was online. So I didn't have any physical in-person contact with people. So already I was starting out on like a really bad note. You know, I was living alone. I all of my community, my friends, my family, they were not physically present in Montreal, which is a really, really hard thing. And then there was a lot of restrictions in the city, the university, you know, all the classes were online. So I never actually got to meet my colleagues until well over a year into my program. So just experiencing that isolation, that, you know, it just started on a bad note. And I know a lot of people had this experience as well. So it's, you know, it was really hard for all of us. And then 2 years into my PhD, my supervisor left. So when I started my PhD, I was working on a completely different project with a different supervisor. And for personal and professional reasons, she decided to leave the university. And, you know, I don't resent her at all for that. Like, I think she made the right decision for her, but that put me in a really difficult position because, you know, I was 2 years in, so I'd already been working on this project and she just left. So I was now left without a supervisor and without a project. So I did take time, you know, a couple months to think about what I wanted to do. The department that I'm in, you know, they had offered different solutions. They said you can either stop, and you know, we'll give you a master's degree. But I didn't want another master's degree. We can, you know, you can just look around and see if there's other supervisors that'd be willing to take you. But that was really hard. You know, I had no idea what to do. Like I think that for me was like one of the really hard situations to navigate, because it was so unexpected and I didn't know what to do. And it's also not something that had happened a lot in the department that I work in. So no one really knew what to do. They were like, "We're so sorry this is happening, but like, we don't really have a solution for you. Like, you're kind of just gonna have to figure it out." And luckily I reached out to my current supervisor and she was like, "Yeah, you know, like, come work in my lab and we'll think of something." So anyways, that worked out really well, but that really made things hard, because it forced me to stop. And it also made me think a lot about, okay, do I really want this? Because like, already it's not going up, like, it's not starting on a good note. Like, do I really want the rest of my PhD to be like this? And the third thing was, I got really sick. So I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. You know, after I got COVID, and then I got really sick, and I was just having all these like lingering symptoms, which later turned out to be an autoimmune disease. So it was just like obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. And at a certain point, I just realized I was running on empty. Like, I could not function. I was feeling really, really badly, both physically and mentally. I noticed it in every aspect of my life. You know, I wasn't doing well in my coursework. I wasn't doing well in my comprehensive exams. I wasn't doing well in my social interactions, you know, with the people that are close to me. Like, I just felt like really, really bad, like something was wrong. And so that accumulation of stuff was when I was like, you know what, this has gone on for too long. I need to take a break for my mental health and my physical health, and just think about what is important right now, which is getting better. And, you know, because you can't thrive like that. Like, when you're feeling so poorly, you're not efficient in your work. You're not, you know, you're just not doing well. So it's really important to just take a break. And unfortunately, I realized that too late. I think I let it get to a point where I was just really, really unwell. But taking that break really made me realize, okay, this is important. Focus on what you need. And once you feel ready to start up again, then you can go back if that's something that I wanted to do. And turns out I did. But anyways, that was my story.
No, that's perfect. And you had the support of your supervisor to take that break, which is also great. So it's not a given for everyone, but I think it was the right thing to do, because the thing is, if you give your health, physical or mental, to the PhD, and then either you stop, or you know, you finish the PhD, but then you don't have health or mental health anymore. If you, once you're out of graduate school, they're not going to give you back your physical health, your mental health, or anything. So it's all, if one of those two things are on the scales of what you need to choose, PhD or my health, health should always come in first place. And I think you did the right thing. And what is beautiful to me is that I look at you today and you're happy about, you're happy with what you're doing. You're doing, you know, you're taking part in events where you put yourself forward and end up having good outcomes from that too. You're excited about your project. Clearly you're passionate about your project, which also I found that it's a really cool one. We didn't really go deeply into it because that's not the aim of the podcast, but clearly you now have a sense of mission, and finishing this project is part of that mission. And now you have all your batteries are full to finish this marathon that is the PhD. One thing we didn't talk about, and that we had talked in the pre-interview, was the fact that above all these things and this like perfect storm that you had to go through in 2022, that you had to take this break, you also mentioned to me that you, if I don't remember if it was 20, anyway, I don't remember the year exactly, but you also got a diagnosis that kind of puts you into the neurodiverse gamut of things. Was that also part of this whole complication of 2022, or not? And please let the listeners know what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, it definitely contributed, I think. But yeah, when I was 22 or 23, now I can't even remember how old I was, but around that time, I got diagnosed with ADHD. And I will say I wasn't shocked by it. The reason I went to get the diagnosis is because I had a very strong suspicion that that was causing a lot of my issues. But, you know, having that diagnosis and realizing, you know, this probably contributed to a lot of the problems that I had when I was younger. You know, I mentioned my issues with math and school. And, you know, this whole time, I think I was just having trouble learning because there was so much else going on in my brain. And yeah, it definitely contributed to, you know, all of these feelings and the burnout and feeling, you know, like I couldn't continue. And yeah, I think a lot of people, again, can also relate to that.
Yeah. And now, so, and where I want to go with this is, again, another element in this puzzle that can be seen as an obstacle to moving forward. And yet you seem to have found a way to follow your passion, to follow your dreams in terms of your research and what you want to do in the future. Can you talk a little bit about once you were, and maybe we can go, you know, we can travel back in time to that moment where you're sick, you ask your PI to take time off, you do take time off. During the middle of this time off, you're probably starting to feel better. What is the inflection point? What happened at this kind of key moment where you went from, maybe this is not for me, maybe this is the universe telling me that I shouldn't be doing this, to, you know, when was this? And I imagine it's a morning when you wake up and you're like, no, this is actually my mission. Do you have some narrative that you can glue to this that I just said, this moment of going from, oh man, this is a perfect storm, I'm going to sink, to then, you know what, I'm going to hang on and I'm going to resume and I'm going to finish. How did you then say, okay, I'm going to use the resources that I have to deal with the problems that I have and, you know, make a good outcome out of this?
I think the moment for me when I realized, you know, I do want to continue, is just, so it was months of reflection. So I took 3 months off during the summer. And I actually, at the time, I was also working at a startup, like a neurotech startup. So I wasn't, you know, doing nothing all day. Like I was at this job, and in that job, I had to do research. And part of this job was, you know, writing literature reviews and coming up with different studies that I could do, and recruiting participants and testing participants. So I was still working in science. And every time I was at work, I kept telling myself, oh, you know, like I could be doing this, but with my own project. And it's not to say that I didn't like what I was doing. I really, really liked the project that I was working on at that job. It's just, I was having these reflections every day of like, oh, you know, you were supposed to be doing this, and you were supposed to kind of be like deciding what you wanted to do for your project and your thesis. And I think having that, you know, that thought every single day while I was on leave, it really made me realize, okay, you know what? You need to go back and do science, because working at the startup, you know, I had so much fun. I loved it. It was a really, really fun job. And it sort of confirmed to me that I do want to stay in this world of science and research, but I also wanted to finish what I had started. So I think it was really helpful for me to have that on the side to sort of, you know, keep me busy. And to also, that made me realize, you know, I want to finish my project.
That's amazing, because what that makes me feel is, so part of you stopping is all the obstacles that we talked about, part of it may have been, and tell me if you agree, you know, part of it may have been the imposter feelings that you've had for a certain amount of time. And here you were outside academia doing research and having fun and having good results. I feel that you slew the dragon of imposter syndrome by doing the thing that you thought, oh, maybe I'm not cut out for this, outside of academia. And then you're like, oh, you know what? This is actually what I'm born to do. And I'm being emphatic at saying that that's what you were born to do, but it feels like that solved your imposter feelings.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I think having this other thing to work on, but outside of the context of academia, you know, it made it fun. And I've talked to a lot of different people about this, but how different the research atmosphere is outside of the university, outside of academia. It's much more laid back. It's a lot less pressure. You know, these are all things that people talk about all the time, but I was living that. I was experiencing it, you know, like going to work in science and, you know, like a neuroscience startup. It was just confirming the fact that I do enjoy this and I do like this and it's something that I want to do. It's just the environment that was so different.
Of course, no, it's amazing. I really like it. And I think it shows, first, it proves something that I think is key for people listening to know, which is there is good and fun and interesting and valid science being done outside the walls of university. And I'm not saying quit your PhD to go do that, but finish your PhD. And then that's one of the things that you can do. And here you were employed by a startup, but once you finish a PhD, you may have a project that leads you to build your own startup. That's a possibility. So I think that it's really, really cool that we got to this story because I think it's a very, very important one in all this process of yours of getting back to where getting back on your feet, back on your horse, and being where you are today. I really, really think it was a pivotal moment for you psychologically, I'd say.
You know, you just mentioned like you can finish your PhD and go do that. And that was also a huge factor in me going back, was just realizing, okay, you know, you're about halfway, a little over halfway done. If you finish it, there is something waiting for you after. And I think I needed that because I think a lot of the times, you know, you're in school, you're doing all these things and you are thinking about the future, but not concretely. Like you're not thinking like, what exactly can I do after this? But having that experience working in science outside of the university, it really made me realize, okay, if you get your degree, you know, you have your PhD, you can use this to do this type of work, because a lot of the startups, you know, you need a PhD or you need an advanced degree. And so for me, it was more like a practical thing at that point. And I was able to frame it of like, in the sense of like, okay, if I get this degree, it's going to open doors for me and I can see myself doing something in the future with this degree. So it was really like the practicality of it really helped in my decision to go back. So I will say that.
It's a really, really important point. Dominique, time has flown. We've covered a lot of what we had discussed. Maybe if you have advice for people who are in graduate school and who need to do some work on the side, you told me that you've always had jobs as you were moving through your academic journey. Is there a general, you know, some general advice around that? And think about someone who's a first gen graduate student and who maybe just arrived from another continent and who is totally, you know, lost as to all of these other things that can be done, need to be done outside of their day-to-day graduate school work. Do you have some advice for them?
Yeah, I will say, so it is possible to do it. I know it can be really daunting, you know, realizing that you have to work and go to school. It's a lot to take in or to take on. But I just want to remind people, like, it is possible and you can do it. One thing that has really helped me a lot is just staying as organized as possible. So I'm one of those people that has like a very detailed calendar. And, you know, at the beginning of the week, I like to sit down and just plan out my week. So if I know that I need to work on Monday and Tuesday, that gives me, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to do my schoolwork. And I think planning and just being organized with your time is so important. I know it sounds kind of obvious and like most people do that, but I think, you know, if you're able to just like take a moment with yourself and like kind of create little slots of times when you know you'll be able to do your schoolwork, that's so helpful. And then just working when you need to work. So I'm someone that does procrastinate a lot, as we all do. But I think that, you know, if you do have a lot going on, it's really important to just like I said, carve out those times in your schedule where you need to work and just force yourself to do it. Because you know that you'll feel a lot better if you get your work done. I don't know if that's the sort of advice that can be helpful.
It's perfect. Another question. If someone's listening, someone who fits this profile that I just shared and wants to reach out to you, is LinkedIn the best way to ask you maybe advice? Because often, like you said, mentorship has been important for you, but I think that you might be now, and I say might be, anyway, I don't want to push you to say anything, but I think you could now maybe be in a mentoring position versus someone who just arrived and just started their PhD journey. What's the best way to reach out to you that is kind of, you know, public and not your direct email address?
Yeah, so I will say I'm super open to that. If anyone has any questions or wants to talk, I would love to hear from them. LinkedIn is great. Yeah, LinkedIn, you can send me a message on there. That's perfect.
Dominique Louer, Louer. You don't need to put the umlaut, but it does an umlaut on top of the E. There we go. The French. Dominique, I have this kind of summary of the story that you shared today and of all you shared. Of course, you said many things. We've covered a lot of ground, like I said. But a week ago, I saw you do a presentation and tried to follow me to this reflection, and then maybe I'll let you have a final word based on what I'm going to share with you. A week ago, I saw you, you know, being handed one of those big checks because you were the winner of this 3-minute thesis competition. You did really well. Ever since I've seen you there, then I you know, we met in person, and now here, all I see in you is there's a lot of positivity. You have this will to learn, to discover. You want to have a project that affects people positively. That came out in your presentation, but it's part of the why I think of your research. And you know, we talked about doing all of this out of spite, and it looks to me that, you know, there's nothing in you that tells me that you're a spiteful person, not at all. And what would you say to this idea that I'm going to share right now? That is, next time you're on a podium, because I think you're going to win other things in the future. What do you think about thanking all these people who were naysayers, let's say, about your future in the past, and actually taking the time to say, thank you. You propelled me into this journey that I am today. What do you think about that idea?
I really like that idea.
There you go. So I think that's, you know, I was talking about spite, and it was just for the fun of it, because I thought it was a funny idea. But I think this is much more aligned with the energy that you give. And I feel that these people helped you somehow. It's hard to say exactly how, but they kind of kindled this fire in you that's been burning until today, and that I feel is going to burn for a long time still. I thank you so much for having shared all these stories with me and with the Papa PhD audience. I'm super, super happy that you accepted this. I wish you all the best for your projects. And I'm super thankful that we crossed paths. and that you accepted to come share your story here today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, and I'm really glad that we were able to have this conversation.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, with me, David Mendes, and my guest, Dominique Louer. If you liked my conversation with Dominique, and if you know someone who's in graduate school or considering graduate school, share the episode with them and let them know about the podcast. It's one of the best ways you can help an independent podcaster like me. Future You needs great colleagues, so share to start the butterfly effect.